Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Robin Allen. Robin Allen is the owner of Forever Books in downtown St. Joseph, and we're going to be talking for our period today about the books that are interesting in the fall of 2022. With Respect, Robin Allen. Robin, how are you today?
I'm great, thanks.
Good, good. So, we got the fall coming up. We're in the fall, rather, and going into the winter and Christmas. And I bet you there are some books out there that are of interest to you.
This is the season, John, for big-name books. Books come out September, October, November, and carry their way, you know, carry through Christmas for Christmas gift-giving, holiday gift-giving. Mm-hmm. So, lot of big books.
Well, let's start off with, how about some fiction? Shall we talk about fiction first?
I thought we would do some mysteries maybe and some really important nonfiction that's just some fascinating stuff.
Okay.
So one of your favorites that comes out tomorrow, November 15th, is The Twist of a Knife by Anthony Horowitz.
Oh, Be Still My Beating Heart.
I know.
I love that guy. He's a great writer.
Well, John, this is the fourth installment of this excellent series. And you have your protagonist, Anthony Horowitz, who is the author, a book within a book kind of thing. He's accused of a crime that he didn't commit. So he's written three books and solved several murders. And he's just ended his partnership with ex-detective Daniel Hawthorne so that he can focus on his play called Mind Game, which is making its West End debut. On opening night, Mind Game receives a horrible review from the Sunday Times critic Harriet Throsby. Early the next morning, Horowitz is awakened by the London police seeking to question him in the murder of the critic, who has just been stabbed to death in her home. So he's under arrest and he needs help, and he goes back to his ex-partner. If you like Agatha Christie-style mysteries that lead to an unexpected reveal, this is for you.
Well, this guy, when he writes books, they are very complex, and they're fascinating as to how he interplays reality, that is, his name, his wife's name, people in London, people around the world, and the plays and the books he's written, and he brings into this character a fictional detective, a detective that doesn't really exist, apparently. And they form this weird partnership. I love it. It's great.
And maybe some of our listeners have heard of the PBS series that's now on. I think it's on part four or part three or something at this point. And it's Magpie Mysteries. And Magpie Murders. And so that, you can see it on PBS. It's really well done. Really well done. But the book is better.
Yeah. I like the book. I like the other books he's come out of in that same series, which actually the Magpie Murders is not a not one of the Hawthorne series. It's a different series he's got going. He wrote probably, I'm told, one of the best TV serials ever done, which is called Foyle's War. About the run-up to and during the Second World War in Britain. And he's Midsummer Murders is his creation initially. So the guy is extremely prolific and very popular but not condescending. He his plots are challenging. I love him. So I'm glad that you recommend you raised that fella, because that's a good book.
It really is. And the next couple of books that I'm going to talk about are both books that my staff has read. The first one is The Cloisters by Katie Hayes. And this is set in the Cloisters Museum in New York. Have you been there?
Never.
I never have either. So I think it's more of a Gothic, 15th century medieval Gothic art collection. Well, this character arrives, Anne Stillwell arrives in New York City, and she's supposed to be a curator at the Met. Instead, she finds herself assigned to the Cloisters. It's a Gothic museum and garden renowned for its medieval art collection. And you have a group of enigmatic researchers studying the history of divination. So she discovers a 15th century deck of tarot cards hidden that might hold the key to predicting the future. And this is what Beth writes in her little review on the shelf. Set in the Cloisters Museum in New York, Hayes' debut novel features murder, history, suspense, ill-advised love, and a tarot deck that actually may predict the future, an attention-grabbing and holding mystery with a satisfying ending.
All right.
And so she really loved that. The next one that she read, she enjoyed so much that Stephen is now reading it. And we rarely double up on books because there's only so many of us in the store. So when we find someone that wants to read, you know, also read the book. And this is called The Night Ship, S-H-I-P, by Jess Kidd, K-I-D-D. And it's based on a true, it's about the lives of two nine-year-olds. One is in 1628 and the other in 1989. And they intersect across time. And it's a moving examination of the real-life wreck of the Batavia, where these people set sail from Harlem to their destination of Batavia, the capital of the Dutch East Indies. And in real life, in 1628, the ship is broken in half and wrecked, and 300 survivors end up on one of the islands where I really don't want to give too much away, but there's this, it's really kind of a mass, I don't know, there's a lot that's going on there. But what Beth writes about, she says it's based on a true and truly horrific, sorry, I had to take a drink, story of a 17th century shipwreck off the coast of Australia. So she says it's historical fiction like she's never read.
And Matt, the name of that book again.
I'm sorry. I've got a little...
That's all right. The name of that book...
Pardon me.
The name of that book and author again are?
The Night Ship by Jess Kidd.
Okay. As in Captain Kidd the Pirate.
Oh, well. Sorry. Get a little... and it's funny that you should say that, because one of the books that's not on this list that I just finished was the story of Captain Kidd's wife. And so there is a book out there that's pretty fascinating stuff, because there's not really a lot about her, but a lot about him. But you talk about a strong woman. It's called The Pirate's Wife. And it really is good.
You know, that's interesting, because so many books are out there the last two or three years that acquire some kind of popularity. And there's The Fisherman's Wife, Everybody's Wife,
Time Traveler's Wife.
And on and on. Boy, all those wives, all of a sudden they're getting a lot of attention. Before that it was all the men that were getting the attention. So now we have the women's side of the same story.
Yes. Well, you've had 200, 300, 500 years of men writing books, so.
Yeah. Okay. We'll get into that.
But you're right. It really is a big popular thing now. It's anything from the bookseller's daughter to the, you know, anything that has book or library or daughter or wife or it's been really popular.
In a previous show that we did, we talked about the book The Midnight Library, which was absolutely fascinating, and I still remember good parts of it and been recommending that to people. It's a really interesting story, I thought. Well, anyway, what else do we have?
Okay. So next on my list is one by Lisa Unger. Have you read any of her books?
Never have.
I never have either, but she's very popular. And this is called The Secluded Cabin Sleeps Six by Lisa Unger, U-N-G-E-R. And you have three couples who rent a luxury cabin in the woods for a weekend getaway. I mean, luxury. And the description is to die for, a weekend getaway to die for. And it's a locked room thriller by this New York Times bestselling author. And this dreamy weekend is about to turn into a nightmare. And of course, you have a deadly storm brewing, and the rental host seems a little too off. And the personal chef reveals that their beautiful house has a spine-tingling history, of course. And the friends have their own complicated past with secrets that run deep. What is the name of that Agatha Christie book? And Then There Were None?
Ten Little Indians, or that was the
Ten
play.
Ten Little Indians.
That was the play that was based on, and Then There Were None. Yes. That's right.
So it kind of reminds me that no one here has read it, but anyone who's read Lisa Unger, really, she has quite a following. So that's what I have for mysteries.
Well, it's interesting. There is a new book out about, I'm just trying to think of the name of it right now, but it's a new Robert Galbraith book that is a pseudonym for
J.K. Rowling,
sorry. And I have not read it yet. It's been sitting there. It's a big, thick fella, and have not read it yet, but I'm looking forward to it because I really like the characters. I like the drama, the plots and everything, and even though it's long. It is long.
It's the Ink Black Heart, right?
That's it. Yeah.
Ink Black Heart, yes. And I have to say this one, I read like her first one and wasn't really impressed, but since then her books have really gotten excellent reviews, and The Ink Black Heart also got really good reviews. So I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
I will, I'm sure. All right. So what else do we have we can talk about?
Okay. Well, I have some nonfiction that is pretty interesting, I have to say. And I think I've read all of these except for one. And I'm reading it now. And Stacy Schiff is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian author. And her new book is The Revolutionary Samuel Adams. And it's about Samuel Adams from revolutionary times. And he was a cousin to John Adams, one of our presidents. And one thing about Samuel Adams, we don't realize that he had such an instrumental role in triggering the events that would lead to the American Revolution. I didn't realize it either. Yes, this is the Samuel Adams of the beer fame. But he's typically overshadowed by such, you know, his contemporaries like Washington, Jefferson, and his second cousin, John Adams. But his behind-the-scenes machinations were really a crucial factor in setting the wheels of revolution in motion. We don't hear much about him because most of his personal papers he burned so that nobody would read them. So she spent quite a few years digging through a lot of this. And it was a lot of it I've just never heard of. I had no idea. So he's more known for beer for our contemporary times, but he had really quite a role in our American Revolution.
And the name of the book again is?
Is The Revolutionary Samuel Adams by Stacy Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F.
All right.
I've read a couple of her other books, really good.
All
and
right.
if we move along to history, we've got one of my absolute favorite authors next to David McCullough is John Meacham.
All right. We're going to take a break now before we get into those other books and talk about these historical writers, which I find very interesting in their own backgrounds. So this is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we're talking to Robin Allen, the owner of Forever Books in beautiful downtown St. Joseph, Michigan. We'll be right back. Back on With Respect with Robin Allen, the owner of Forever Books, and we're talking about the new books that are coming out this fall, 2022, and looking towards the big book giving splurge at Christmas time. This is John Smetanka. So, Robin, when we broke, you started to talk about some other historical authors, that is, nonfiction writers. So, let's start from the beginning.
Yes, and this is my favorite genre, is nonfiction, whether it's science or history, whatever. But this one is John Meacham, who's one of my absolute favorite writers and historians. And this book is And There Was Light, Abraham Lincoln and the American Struggle. And I think it's more of Abraham Lincoln's struggle with how he had to confront secession, threats to democracy, and the tragedy of slavery. He's a president who governed a divided country, which has much to, I would say, teach us in the 21st century that we have a polarization. And I mean, he doesn't talk about present, so it's not a preaching political,
mm-hmm.
but he's given us a Lincoln. You'd think that there's not one more Lincoln book that could be written. But this one is a whole different view of Lincoln, and I would say it's a really smart book. This man is a genius, and I'm not worked my way all the way through it because there's a lot of meat in there for me to contemplate. So,
are you talking about the author is a genius or Lincoln?
The author, I think, is. If just to hear him speak is, he's quite a challenge to my intellect, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is Lincoln. You talk about the plethora of books that he has been the subject of, and looking all around. I remember I was with a U.S. attorney from the western part of Virginia many years ago, and a nice man, very, very well respected in the group. Was not a rabble rouser, just quietly doing his job. And he was a Lincoln devotee. And he talked about Lincoln as a lawyer. And he wrote a book in that, short book in that vein, and sent it to me. An absolutely fascinating study of Lincoln as a lawyer, which has now recently been updated also by another author talking about Lincoln as a trial lawyer. And there's so many aspects to this this Lincoln fellow that we are continually confronted with all of the different facets of his life and his personality and his accomplishments that I suspect will continue to fascinate authors and researchers you know, for another 100 years, I suspect. Just an interesting man, interesting mm-hmm. writing. I started the book, which has been The Definitive Life of Lincoln, by Carl Sandburg, a threesome book, about the prairie years and the war years and whatnot, and just a really, really well written and very interesting. And part of that book was written while he was living in Berrien County, Michigan. And a fascinating story in that regard. But at any rate, I share your interest. We've talked about my favorite historian, Lynn Olson, who talked about in several books, six or seven books, about the period from, say, 1935 through the Second World War. And again, a dynamic writer. You just can't put, once you start, you can't put the book down. Lots of things to think about and sticks with you for a long time. So I want to add that in simply because
he does have a new book, and Lynn Olson has a new book coming out in February.
Ooh, cool. All right.
It's called Empress of the Nile, the daredevil archaeologist who saved Egypt's ancient temples from destruction.
Very interesting.
And this, as a matter of fact, if it's what I think, who I think it is, there was a PBS documentary about this man who moved these temples because when the Aswan Dam mm-hmm. was being built, moved all of those temples so that they would be saved. Just amazing. So I can't wait to read this.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you mentioned that. It reminded me.
Well, when I talked to her in one of my shows, what she said was that in every book that she writes, she looks for somebody, some person that is perhaps an underdog, someone who mm-hmm. hasn't gotten a lot of attention. In one of those books called The Citizen of London, she highlighted a fellow by the name of but he was the ambassador, the American ambassador to the Court of St. James, Britain, leading right into the first part of the war and on through. And this man was a powerful figure behind the scenes in bringing the United States and Britain together in many ways. And was respected by the common people. The story opens with this man with coming out of a theater in London in 46 or 47, and unassuming, quiet, and people saw him. They came up to him and kept saying, you know, thank you, thank you, thank you for all your work, which is amazing for a diplomat who kept his distance from publicity during that time. He did some remarkable things. But at any rate, it's a great book, Citizens of London. Go ahead. What's next?
Interesting. Well, I guess if we're going to move through history, the next one fits into this. This is called Appy's Berlin Diaries, My Quest to Understand My Grandfather's Nazi Past by Gabrielle Robinson. She's going to be signing on Small Business Saturday, which is November 26th from 1 to 3. She got her PhD at the University of London and has been teaching here in the U.S. for many, many years, is now retired, of course, and is a professor emeritus. And she, you know, it offers a personal perspective on the fall of Berlin in 1945 and the far-reaching aftershocks of the Third Reich. After her mother's death, the author was thrilled to find her grandfather's war diaries, only to discover that he had been a Nazi. So it shows him as a doctor in Berlin, desperately trying to help the wounded in cellars without water or light, and his anxiety and despair. And so he had this daily diary. So she retraces his steps 50 years later and tries to come up to answers why he joined the Nazi Party. Well, at the same time, she remembers the happiest years of her childhood with him. So it's kind of, you know, we all need to kind of reckon with our country's past and sometimes with our own family's past. So it should be, I have started it, but I have not finished it. And while she will just be signing, we're hoping that in sometime this spring, I'd like to have her come and speak and also sign. So that should be interesting.
Sure. What else do we have?
Okay. We also have Clint Hill was moving forward in time here. The Secret Service agent to Jacqueline Kennedy has written a memoir, his latest memoir, and he has recollections of trips that he took with her, and along with more than 200 rarely or never previously published photographs. And they see her in private moments. And it's kind of a multidimensional depiction of an unusually deep relationship that he acknowledges he never crossed the line into romance, but they were very close. And he provided her with comfort and security that went beyond friendship. So this shows her as she really was, fun-loving, adventurous, spontaneous, down-to-earth, and elegant at the same time. So that is out.
Well, he's well known.
Yes.
For his being around the Kennedys, I think during the period of the assassination, mm-hmm. As well as afterwards, he's a very well known guy. So, very interesting. Go ahead. What else?
Yeah, he did write a book too, Mrs. Kennedy and Me, like 10 years ago, so or more. So this is a kind of a follow-up. I think this is maybe a little more lighthearted and more photographs that have never been seen. So one of my favorite books is, it comes out December 6th. It's called Your Table is Ready, Tales of a New York City Maitre d'. I cannot pronounce his last name. It is Italian. It's Michael Cecchi Azzolina, C-E-C-C-H-I. hyphen A-Z-Z-O-L-I-N-A, Michael Cecchi Azzolina. So this is a sort of Without Reservations by Anthony Bourdain kind of thing, where there's shocking and I have to say there's titillating revelations about the behind-the-scenes shenanigans in the 35 years he was also a server and general manager of several New York City restaurants. Who was the one who was for Danny Meyer? And Danny Meyer at one time worked at the bistro here on the boulevard before he went to New York City and opened all these restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really highly entertaining stuff, a lot of name dropping, some shocking things, one story that's not so shocking that can be repeated on the radio.
Oh, here we go.
No, I won't tell that story. There are some that you're just like, but this one is a woman came in and whispered to him that she needed a private room for this guest who was, I think, maybe by herself. I don't know. And he said, there's no way. I'm sorry. We don't have a special room. All our guests are treated equally. And she said, but this is for royalty. And Michael says, I don't care. I really don't care. So she said, I need empty tables on either side. And he did not acquiesce. Come to find out, she said, it's the girlfriend of royalty. This is New York City. Guess. Now, they would not say who it is, but we're thinking, of course, Meghan Markle.
Mm-hmm.
So he does name some names, but not as many, but it is. And it's also was during the times of Studio 54. What is the name of the famous restaurant that in New York City on the lake that is, I can't remember what it is, but you'd recognize some of these restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty famous. And of course he does give some ideas on what you should and should not do when approaching a maitre d'.
Now that's helpful because
Yes.
You go to a nice restaurant, and but they don't know who you are.
Right.
And you want to get a table, and there's a line 3.25 miles long.
Right.
And you want to say, should I offer a bribe? Should I just, should I compliment the man? Shall I tell him about my sick mother who's about to die? I mean, is there, what in heaven's name is going to get me a table before I fall out of starvation?
Oh, it's Tavern on the Green. It just Tavern came to my brain.
Okay.
But you're right. A lot of times he does talk about offering money. But I think, you know, what you want to, as I saw once on a Sex and the City, if I, she says, hand her to $50. She says, if I had $50, you know, I could eat. So I don't even know if $50 would do it, but it was because some of the restaurants that he was in, but it really is fascinating stuff. And, you know, you're behind the scenes. So it's a little bit voyeurism,
yeah,
which is fun.
All right, we're going to take another break right now. We're talking to Robin Allen, who is the owner of Forever Books. And on our quarterly study of what's out there, what's interesting to read, what's good to give, what's good to receive, we'll be right back. This is John Smetanka. Back on With Respect with Robin Allen, the owner of Forever Books in beautiful downtown St. Joseph. And we've been talking now about the time of maybe gift giving in the fall going into the winter, the Christmas season of 2022. This is John Smetanka. Now, I've got one for you. This is an old book. I'm not even sure if it's in print anymore, but it may be in a library somewhere. And it was brought to mind by what you were talking about, the woman who was trying to figure out about her ancestor who was a Nazi. And you talked about starting with the battle, the fall of Berlin, and going on through the area of Germany and the world, and the events that happened afterwards, after the war. And it put me in mind of a book called To Marietta from Paris. And it's Marietta Tree, who is a woman who was part of a social set in the United States on the East Coast. And it's letters written to her by her friend Susan Mary Alsop. And Susan Mary Alsop was married to a fellow who was in the American Diplomatic Corps and was assigned to Europe during and after the Second World War. And part of that time was in Paris, some of the time was in Italy, and so on. But it's written in letter format. And I started this, I thought, oh, man, this is just going to be some, you know, we saw bombs fall and we went to a cocktail party. Quite the contrary. This is a gripping book because this woman was part of a special class of people, you know, well-educated, well-married. But they were in, you know, she and her husband were real devotees of America and its vision in the post-war area, but her description of Paris in the time after the freeing of Paris from the Nazi rule, and on through Yes, and there was one of their own mini revolutions was absolutely gripping. I could not put it down. And it's a description of social life, of business life, of diplomatic life, and it's a sort of a, you know, very well known people in the certainly in the literary and the diplomatic world. And I just thought it was a great book, and so I recommend it because I read it. I love it.
Excellent. Excellent. I love in the bookstore, complete strangers will come up to each other and say, oh, I read that, it's fabulous. Or, oh, there's another book like that. If you like that one, you'll love this one.
Well, I'm going to put a bug in your ear after we've gone through books. I want a bug in your ear for your comments on the importance of word of mouth in people choosing what books to read or to read at all. So, but let's go on with the books you've been talking
I just
about.
Have a few more. I think only have like three more books. And
go ahead.
So the next one is, I'm going to go take a little aside here. And this book is called How to Speak Whale by Tom Mustill, M-U-S-T-I-L-L. And you can actually get online and you will see Tom Mustill is a biologist. And he and this other woman are in a kayak off the coast of California when a whale breaches on top of his kayak.
Ooh.
They both live. But you can actually look it up online and see it happening. It'll boggle your mind. So it begins a journey for him to understand how whales communicate and, you know, what was this whale trying to tell him? And actually, they ended up finding at the end of the book, they ended up finding this same whale, which it's fascinating how science has, you know, preceded all of this. Now, the whole whaling industry, commercial whaling, really there was a time when it was so unbelievably awful. But this Mustill found this biologist who I won't tell you exactly why he got into this because the story is pretty gruesome, but he begins to start recording whale song. I mean, nobody talked about whale song in the 70s or anything, but this was created into a record and it was put into everyone who had a subscription to the National Geographic. And people went crazy over it, you know, hundreds of thousands of people went crazy over it. And it really brought to the attention what was going on with commercial whaling. And that record actually made it into the Voyager satellite that was put into space, where they recorded human, all different languages. You remember that?
I do. Yes, I do.
Okay. So that record ended up there. So it's really meaty stuff and really interesting stuff. And I really, really enjoyed it.
As long as you're talking about whales, there's an interesting book. Again, this is not new. It's a classic in, I guess you would say, science fiction, although it's as much social commentary as anything. Very funny. The great author, Douglas Adams, wrote a series of books, starting with The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. And he then also wrote a book, Goodbye and Thanks for All the Fish, in which saving the whales and saving the dolphins became it's an interesting hook for this story to talk about alien life. Anyway, great writer, very funny, and that was, you know, again, one of those things that you tie space into whale sounds, and it came to mind.
Okay. All right. So I think I just have two more. This is called Con/Artist: The Life and Crimes of the World's Greatest Art Forger by Tony Tetro, T-E-T-R-O. And he was one of the most prolific art forgers of the 20th century. And keep in mind what he used back then. There's no way he could get away with it now. And he even admits that now. So he kind of paints his own life story with really great flair. And living in New York in the 1960s, he started by freehand drawing from examples in his mother's photo magazines, and over time taught himself techniques from art books. Now, when he was 16, his girlfriend got pregnant, but he would stay up late making these elaborate copies of Rembrandt, Renoir, Picasso. And he and his young family relocated to Southern California, and he took all these low-paying jobs. But on his off time, he discovered museums, and he started dabbling in forgeries offered in auction in the early 70s. And his first one was selling a fake Chagall sketch to a local art gallery. And this just blew up. I mean, he developed methods to create provenance or realistic history to the paintings. For example, he would use smudged cigarette ash on the back of a faux Dali. And what followed were, and it was amazing because a lot of people knew and a lot of art dealers knew that they were forgeries. But when you can sell them for $250,000 to, and up, you know, what led to fancy cars and lavish parties and traveling the world. But we know the law caught up with him. But it is, he turned out okay. It's sort of like the art world's the Wolf of Wall Street kind of thing, you know, the big high and the big low kind of thing. So it was in 1989, he was convicted of art forgery in a really heavily publicized trial in Los Angeles. And one of the co-author with him is a journalist, and he has extensive experience in investigative and hard news documentary. He was the one who broke the story of, he's producing a feature documentary on Prince Charles art forgery scandal, where these were copies, none of Tetro's, but it is in the book, about Prince Charles was given this paintings for his collection, and they were all forgeries. And it was a big scandal. I think it was in 2019, something like that. So it really is fascinating. You're just, it's almost like a movie. I would make a fabulous movie. And great, great reading. Really enjoyed it.
You know, in a sidelight to that, some years ago when I was a U.S. attorney, I tried a case in front of a judge in Kalamazoo, federal judge, and the topic of this trial was we were prosecuting a fellow who had apparently or allegedly stolen a number of Dali, Salvador Dali, art works. And the story of what Dali did produce was absolutely fascinating. He produced plateware for dinners that were, some of them were, but to look at them, I don't know how you could eat the food in front of you on the table, on the platform, because it was so weird. But part of that was he was selling material with Dali's signature on it, which wasn't really genuine. That was fascinating to our judge, who spent a lot of time talking to the art expert and the victim, whose matter was things were stolen, about Dali and about his background. And it was a great diversion from sitting and listening to stuff that really dealt with guilt and innocence. I mean, he was more interested in Dali than I think he was in the. He left up the guilt or innocence to the jury. But at any rate, it was fascinating to see in the art world what is and what is not really genuine.
And there's so much of it. It's just unbelievable. And what these forgers go through to make it real. I mean, at one point he used pizza ovens to heat the paintings. And he would do it like a sludge. He would smoke these cigarettes and then, you know, get this brown sludge on it. And I mean, just, you're like, really? But, you know, here's a man who was probably a mediocre painter, at best. Maybe he was good, but he wasn't going to make a living from it. Mm-hmm. And he saw a way to make a ready buck. And what's fascinating too is I don't know if this is true, but the first thing he did was he kept buying these cars. And I mean, Rolls Royce and Lamborghinis and just unbelievable Ferraris, and lost it all. But there's more to it than that, but it really makes for some fascinating reading.
Well, he was probably a loner. That is, he had to keep his work to himself.
Yes.
But it proves in this and many other situations that I can think of, underline the truth of the old, I think it was Shakespearean or pre-Shakespearean phrase, which went, down to Gehenna, as hell, down to Gehenna, up to the throne, he travels fastest who travels alone. And you look around at some of these folks, Bernie Madoff or some of the great cons, they give the truth to what my mother used to say about the liar, the habitual liar. And that is that habitual liar is a very unhappy person. It's not because that person has to keep track of their lies. That's relatively simple. But what it is we always judge other people by ourselves. And if we are liars, we have to look at those other people, and our presumption is that they're lying, and therefore you cannot trust anybody. So you're living in a world where you are the only thing that you have to deal with, that's your only perspective, and it's unhappy. It's a very unhappy time, even though they have the Lamborghinis and the and the whatnots.
And that's so true. What you just said is exactly true of this, after reading this book. That's exactly true of this man, too.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take another break right now. We're talking to Robin Allen, who is the owner of Forever Books in downtown St. Joseph, Michigan. We're talking about books which might be of interest to people or readers or gift givers in the fall of 2022. This is John Smetanka, and we will be right back. Back on With Respect with Robin Allen, the owner of Forever Books in St. Joseph, Michigan. We've been talking about books for giving and books for reading in this fall of 2022. This is John Smetanka. So now I come down to, unless you have another book that you
I only have one more book.
All right, then highlight.
I only have one more book.
Then highlight
it's, I have not read it yet. I think I might have gave you a copy of it too. It's Historic Shipwrecks and Rescues on Lake Michigan by Michael Passwater. And some of it is a lot has to do with our area too, in the St. Joseph area. And there are photographs in there. I have not read it yet. I have it at home. He is signing on November 30th and going to do a talk, but it looks really interesting. So,
interestingly, he will be a guest on one of our shows in the future.
Oh, wonderful. 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 And so that's all I have.
All right. Well, now here's my turn to kind of get your views on something which has always intrigued me. What is the motivating factor that gets people, either as individuals or groups, to go after a particular work? Now, let's talk, we're now talking about books here. You could toss out movies as well, or records or whatever, but I'm going to talk about books. There's advertising, and I've been one of those people who signed an endorsement of a book or two. And so when people pick up that book, they'll see that John Smetanka endorsed this book or liked it or liked the author or whatever. But then there's a lot of money put into the publishing business. The publishers will get out and send their authors on book tours, and they'll come to all different kinds of places around the country and talk and sell their book, and so on and so on and so on. But there is one thing which is not as well discussed, I don't think, and that is word of mouth. And you've alluded to this word of mouth thing over the years that we've been doing this show. And I want to focus now and get you to talk about what your experiences are in these various kinds of ways of bringing books to people's attention. What do you think?
Well, you were talking earlier about books. I would tell you about a book, and then you would bring up a book. And I think these are books that resonate to you, that touches you deeply somewhere in your mind and heart, and you can't help but talk about it. When you go to a great restaurant and have a fabulous meal, you get two things. You either get, oh my gosh, I hate this, and then everybody knows about it, or oh my gosh, I love this, and everybody knows about it. So it has to hit you one way or the other. I mean, haven't we all read books and went, oh, why? Why did I read this book? It was a waste of time.
Yeah, you and I have talked about.
Yes, it didn't resonate.
It was an awful, horrible book.
Awful, horrible book.
Yeah.
And there are people, I can list a couple of books that I just hated, and people just love the book. And I think there's something. I know in the store, someone will look at the reviews that are on the shelf there, and they have maybe set a relationship with another person, whether it's the bookseller, a friend, or maybe even a stranger that smiles or, you know, in the bookstore. But the enthusiasm that one person has, it's infectious. And who knows what really will, sometimes someone will recommend a book, and I have read this author's works and went, oh no, this is not for me. But just the fact that this person is so excited about it, it gives me a sense of pleasure to know that they loved, that a book has touched them. Because if you are a reader, or when you read a book and it has touched you, it changes you. You're not the same person because it has affected you. If it's fiction, it's usually empathy, or it resonates with your life, or whether it affects you with love or danger or excitement of some sort. And that is the magic of books.
You know, it's interesting you mention that, because I have a granddaughter, and this granddaughter loves for me to read to her. And one of the books I was looking last year for a gift for her birthday or Christmas, I can't remember which, and Diane gave me a book, and it's Robert Frost's Stopping by the Woods on a snowy evening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a poem that he wrote, and is very famous. But this author illustrated it, took a whole unique way of looking at the story behind the poem, as she wrote it, and it caught the attention of my granddaughter, who's 6 years old, and it caught her attention at when she was 5 years old, and we would read it. And today, when we get together again, first thing she says is, Grandpa, let's read Stopping by the Woods. And she now reads along with me. She will read the words and listen to the sound and tie them together with the pictures, the illustrations. And I'm so happy because Frost happens to be one of my favorite poets, and the book is one of my favorites. And here I've got.
If a stranger had read her that book, it wouldn't be the same, John, than her grandfather.
Maybe.
I mean, of course, it was a good. It's great. It's wonderful. But there is an attachment there because of that book. Yeah. For my nieces, we would every night that I was there at their parents' house and took care of them, they pick out three books and we'd lay on the living room floor and read those books. It was just a tradition.
Well, I did this with my daughter, and it's not, we had different kinds of books that we read. And I'm not going to get into all of that. It's personal, but I found that it was a great pleasure to me to read to my daughter, to my granddaughter, to either one of my granddaughters. And it's an added extra to reading for yourself, because there's this tangible bond that between you and the book and the person you're reading to. And you're right. It's the bond between that triangle, you, the other person, and the book that makes all the difference and makes for memories, which going back. I remember books that I was read by my parents when I was a kid, and I have that special memory. And when I start talking, well, for example, to Marietta from Paris, which I talked to you about, I got that from my mother, and I thought, well, that's so boring. And I couldn't put it down. And every time I pick it up again, and I do, I think of my mother, as well as the content of the book. So,
have you ever read a book maybe when you're younger, or went back to it when you're older?
Oh yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite examples of that was the book Dr. Zhivago, which I read when I was 13 to start with, because I was at a family Christmas party where I was bored with everybody there, and all of my cousins were, in my mind, people I didn't want to spend the night with. And so I went into a corner and I found this book. It has just been published by an American publisher. It was a Russian novel by Boris Pasternak, for which he got the Nobel Prize. And I remember sitting in a corner reading it. And here's a twist. I didn't get the whole book read, but my aunt, who I did not know, had a love of literature, watched me and asked me as I was leaving, did you like that book? I said, I loved it. And about 3 days later, in the mail, came a copy of that book. And I always remembered my aunt with great favor after that. And I will tell you, I took that book home, back to school, and instead of studying for my exams, the midterms, I sat in the back with the usual, big brown paper thing in the front so no one saw what I was reading during study period. I would read Dr. Zhivago instead of studying. And darn, I got the best grades I've ever gotten.
Your mind was working.
Yeah. But at any rate, I think that flows from what I started to raise, which is the interrelationship between people, word of mouth, or the bond. I think you brought out that extremely well. So, and you know, everybody should take delight at some point in their lives if they have a career that they enjoy. Looking back and saying to themselves, what makes me happy? I mean, as a lawyer, I'm happy when my client does well during my representation and afterwards. And when you are selling books and people come back to you and talk about them, you got to feel really good.
Oh, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. That's, for years I was looking for my passion. What is my passion? People say, go after your passion. And I can truly say that I can't even think about retiring. People are saying, well, you're getting up there, Robin. getting ready to retire. But when you love what you do, why do you want to stop? So,
that's right.
Yeah. Even it, and it really overcomes a lot of the stress and anxiety, because there are things, like everyone who has their own business or works for themselves, there is stress and responsibility that sometimes, you know, kind of really affects your love for what you do. But it's when it gets to the point where that is worse than the good stuff, then maybe it is time to retire. Yeah. But not yet for me.
Yeah. All right. Robin Allen, thank you very much for your time and all your recommendations and your thoughts about reading.
Thank you, John.
This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect. And remember, we're on every week. And during the time between now and then, remember our mantra. If you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.
And read a good book today.
And read a book.